You're listening to 23 Jungle Tales, all on the Sports Objective. Between now and opening day, we will talk to 23 former Pirate baseball players about their path to East Carolina, their time in the purple and gold, and what they're up to now. Now let's talk Pirate baseball.
Welcome into 23 Jungle Tales right here on the Sports Objective, and we're very excited to have a very special guest. But Bubba, before we get to that, we are brought to you by PGXGloves.com. Mark Minicossi, appreciate all he's done for the program of East Carolina, and obviously he's doing a great job at PGXGloves.com. And Bubba, he's got everything, right?
Yeah, and Coach Eason is joining us today, Tommy Eason, that played for the Pirates in 89 to 91, and then obviously it was on the staffs of Keith LeClair and then also Randy Mazey from 98 to 2005. He was there when Kaz was playing third base for the Pirates. But Kaz, he decided to open PGX Gloves back after he finished his playing days, and they offer customized and personalized batting gloves, also football and golf gloves, and then obviously the swag as well. But since Dave is obviously no longer with us, but without any further ado, let's welcome in Tommy Eason. Coach, how are you?
I'm doing good, Bubba. Thanks for having me.
Coach, I'm here, but couldn't unmute the mic, unfortunately. That kind of day. But, Coach, very excited to have you on, and want to talk about your career going all the way back. Can you talk about your recruitment and how you became a Pirate?
Oh, wow. Recruitment back when I was coming in was obviously totally different than it is now, where, you know, you're signing or committing when you're a freshman, sophomore in high school. Unfortunately, you know, my high school coach, Rabbit Fulgham, basically reached out to East Carolina. East Carolina had recruited me a little bit, not a ton. And back then it was about letters, you know, and they had heard that I had gotten a letter from Clemson. Well, I think back then Terrell Thomas was at that time the recruiting coordinator at Clemson, and they had just heard through the grapevine that I was being recruited by Clemson. Well, there was a catcher in Goldsboro by the name of Mike Kuchar that played Legion ball for Coach Fulgham, and he had signed to go down to Clemson. He ended up being a 6th-round draft pick out of high school and turned it down. And basically said, I'm not going down to sit behind Mike Kuchar at Clemson, and kind of got back on, East Carolina's radar when Rabbit called Billy Best and said, hey, you know, he really wants to be a Pirate. And I think I signed 2 weeks before school started. Like I said, totally crazy situation. I had a great high school career. And, you know, it was meant to be. My brother was already at East Carolina. My family lived in Greenville, just, closest to home. And ended up being a great situation for me.
You know, Coach, obviously current head coach for the Pirates, Cliff Godwin's a Green Central boy. His father, Lewis, was a basketball coach there. I know Cliff played football. What other sports did you play? And then, in addition to what other sports did you play, just tell us about Coach Fulgham. Obviously, he's a legend in Eastern North Carolina and just North Carolina high school baseball.
Yeah, I mean, you know, back, you know, when we were coming through at that time, back in the late 80s, Green Central was a kind of a powerhouse in high school baseball. I played football, you know, it was kind of, you know, following kind of in my brother's footsteps per se. He ended up, you know, playing rugby in college, and that was kind of how, you know, the jungle actually started. You know, a lot of people, you know, say that they started it, next person started. The rugby team back in the late 80s, early 90s, when I played, was really when the jungle actually started. And it was a, you know, great atmosphere. But, you know, football was a passion. I mean, Friday nights, I wouldn't trade them for anything in the world. But football and baseball are really the only two sports I played. I'm not a basketball guy, and never have been. So it just wasn't a passion of mine. So I took advantage of my high school days playing football. And then obviously, you know, once you took the helmet off, it was time to go play baseball.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up about the jungle. Here recently we had Tim Langdon on. And Tim, of course, you know, and played from 86 to 90. And like you and I were talking about that last night, Coach. But, you know, Tim, he was talking about that 90 season. And we'll talk about this in more detail. But Tim said that your brother and the rugby guys were out there in left field. And that's when a lot of the jungle, like you were saying, got started.
Yeah, it was, I guess, with, you know, my connection through my brother and that rugby crowd, you know, they had to do something to, you know, they always wanted to be the spotlight of something. And you know, they were loud, and, you know, they were pretty tame. You know, we beat Carolina 2-1, and they were ranked like third in the country. And, you know, rugby has its, you know, it has its traditions. And some of them were not so, maybe not the right thing to do, but back then there was no social media, so, which is a good thing. So one of them ended up naked on the field right as the game ended. And that's one of the reasons Carolina for about 5 years wouldn't come back to East Carolina and play, unfortunately. And I think those wounds have healed. And but, you know, here again, it was a big win for the Pirates that we weren't ranked at the time, and we ended up beating them, and they were, I think, ranked third in the country.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Tim said as far as Coach Mike Roberts. He said he was a guy that he was pretty on edge, or the exact way to put it. But when he saw that in left field, that he said, that is why I don't come here to play.
Yeah, it was like I said, you know, and most of the fans have left at that time. And so fortunately, not a lot of fans saw that. But in fact, I think Carolina's team was on the bus and they all started coming back off the bus, which, you know, nothing ended up happening after that. But, you know, it's definitely a something you'll never forget if you were involved in it.
And, Coach, it certainly is a Carolina is always using the excuse not to come to Greenville anyway, right?
I guess. You know, we always had great competition as a player and also as a coach. And, you know, it's a great rivalry game, and I hope they continue, you know, now that Coach Forbes has taken up a great situation to play everybody in this. Did y'all lose me?
Coach, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Dave. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Coach.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. Yeah, we're good. We're good now, Coach. I think Dave may have been trying to mute himself, and he accidentally muted you. But no, back in 2018, that series where the Pirates and the Tar Heels played on Friday in Greenville, Saturday at the DBAP, and then Sunday in Chapel Hill, that was awesome. And obviously that was Coach Fox and Coach Godwin that had agreed to that. So we'll see. Maybe that will be in the future.
Yeah, I think that Coach Godwin and Coach Forbes now have a good relationship. And here again, you know, I think it's – fortunately for me, when I played – it was more regional with the CAA, and you know, unfortunately, like in today's time, you know, it's going to be tough to travel across the country with the COVID restrictions and stuff. And the more regional games you can play is definitely, I think, something that is a must, especially where they are right now. We talk about it even at our level. You know, if one team gets COVID in our region and contact tracing comes up, and you may have two teams that end up affecting four teams. So we've been a little bit more flexible on our schedule this year than probably ever. And but hopefully, you know, we don't have to worry about it. Hopefully everybody takes care of themselves, and you know, we're doing everything we can as far as weekly testing and making sure that, you know, our guys are masked up. And you know, it's a different day and age, and you know, our guys have bought into it, and they're just ready to play now.
Coach, before I get to my next question, John Gast, your teammate, chiming in. He said Tommy is the man.
No, John Gast was the man. He was a great teammate and great person, and he's really one of the reasons I'm in the Hall of Fame. He and several other of those guys, a lot of those guys. I mean, you know, it takes a team, you know, to win championships, and we were fortunate to win, you know, basically the opportunity to play in a regional all 3 years I was in college, and we were really good my first 2 years. I mean, I thought we could play against anybody, and you know, we kind of held our own against everybody. So you know, it's a, like I said, today's day and age, it's more national with East Carolina being in the American Athletic, and you know, they compete at a high level over there, and you know, I really enjoyed when they started pairing up the teams in the past and talking about which team was the best. And obviously I was a part of you know, as a coach of several of those teams. And then, you know, as a player being a part of that 1990 team, you know, it makes you feel good that, you know, you were a part of those championships. And, you know, but it was only because of great teammates and obviously great players in our program when I was coaching at East Carolina.
So take us back to the fall of 88 and with the, you know, with you coming into the program, just talk about what the depth chart was like at catcher. And I know you obviously made an impact right from the get-go.
Well, I mean, Chris Caldwell was a senior that year, and we had brought in another catcher from Lewisburg, and it's Corey Short, and he ended up playing a lot of first base, and Chris and I kind of somewhat platooned. I ended up playing a lot of outfield my freshman year, and unbeknown to me, I'd never played outfield in my life, and you know, it was kind of a funny story. Go down to South Carolina, and Coach Overton, I never really understood it, and you know, it was up to him. He was the coach, but he put me in left field and put John Adams at DH, and I'd never played left field in my life. And as I'm running to the field, at the time I didn't have a hat. I was a catcher, so I had a skull. And you know, it's like John Olerud.
Yeah,
Olerud in left field, and I came off the field. Coach O goes, "Where's your hat?" I said, "Well, Coach, I never got a hat." "Oh, we need to get you a hat." I said, "Well, that'd be great." I said, but, you know, I ended up wearing my Scully in left field the entire game just because I didn't have a hat.
Yeah, that's something I definitely had not heard, but you read my mind. I was going to mention John Olerud because I remember what not to get off on a tangent, but what he had some condition where if he got hit in the head, he was maybe – was he a little more exposed to something than the general person? Or is that what it was?
Yeah, he had a medical condition that he had to wear a hat, helmet.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and after, you know, I played probably, I can't even remember the split, probably about 15 games in the outfield, and then most of the other games at, you know, behind the dish. So, you know, Chris Cobble was a great catcher, and I think he ended up hitting over 300 that year as a senior. And, you know, I was fortunate to – I think I ended up hitting third on that team. I think I hit third every year until my junior year, and it was a standing joke. Nobody wanted to hit fourth. It seemed like when you got put in a four hole, you went in the slump or something. So we always kind of joked about that with our – with our team, looking at the lineup, you know, expecting to be in the lineup, but hoping you weren't in the four hole. So that was kind of a standing joke with that 1990 and 1991 team.
And right now I'm living in China Grove, Coach, and I'm like 3 miles from Carson High School. And of course, Coach Cobble is the head coach there.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, it took me a couple of years to figure out his son was the manager for the baseball team. And I ended up giving him a buzz one day, or I ran into him at Chico's, and I was like, man, you got to be kidding me. You come to Greenville, come see your son, you don't give me a call. but, you know, Chris and I stay in touch every once in a while. You know, obviously he'll call me about players from Carson. And, you know, I try to stay in touch with him too. Just, you know, it's tougher right now recruiting and, you know, picking his brain about, you know, kids from Rowan County and the Charlotte area. And just, you know, you have to use your, you know, the people you trust the most, especially in today's environment in the recruiting world, you know, because of the way high school baseball was shut down last year, some of the restrictions on recruiting. So, you know, right now, the people that I've trusted over the course of my coaching career, I have to trust even more so now.
And during your time as a Pirate coach from 89 to 91, three straight CAA titles, three straight trips to the NCAA tournament. So starting with that in 89 season, just talk about all the success that those ball clubs had, and then we'll hone in on, you know, some of the like other seasons like 90 and 91.
You know, 89 was, you know, obviously, I think a great year for us. You know, you really don't know what to expect. College baseball back then is not the attraction that it is now. Even though we had, you know, great crowds at Harrington and, you know, we'll go on the road. The crowds were just okay. That was, you know, that was the good thing about playing at home. But they also, you know, playing in a regional type setting, you know, with Wilmington and James Madison, George Mason, Richmond, you know, VCU came in after the fact. So they weren't in the league at that time. And, you know, it was awesome. You know, you knew that when you went on the road that, you know, 90% of our fans were basically our parents. And we did have, you know, some people following us at the time. But so it kind of eased you into, you know, maybe some hostile environments because you knew your fan base was there pulling for you, you know, whereas the national – type schedule to East Carolina plays. You go to Houston, well, Houston's going to dominate the crowd just because it's on the road. But, you know, so easing into environments, you know, away from, you know, Harrington was a little easier for us. And then, you know, obviously when we got, you know, into championship play, whether it was, you know, I think two of the three CAA championships at Wilmington. And, you know, we played one at home and two in Wilmington, and winning all three of those championships was, you know, a little bit different each time. But, you know, in 89, you know, we had great pitching staff. Those guys, you know, were a little bit more veteran, and we had some guys that led the way. We had, you know, some older players that, you know, just led by example. And, you know, that was a great situation. Billy Best was there as an assistant coach at the time. And, you know, back then, I mean, Billy Best was the only, you know, it's kind of back in the day where you had a grad assistant and then you had, you know, the full-time assistant, which was Billy my first year, and then obviously Coach O. So, you know, having the opportunity to play that regional schedule made the transition from high school to college baseball at the time for me a little bit easier.
In that 1989 CAA tournament that was down in Wilmington at Brooks Field, I know Tim Langdon talked about that because you guys lost 4-2 in 10 innings to George Mason in the opener and then had to win four straight. And that fourth win to bring home the title was against the Richmond Spiders 2-1 in 11 innings.
Yeah, baseball in the CAA back in those days, if I'm not mistaken, it was the fourth best conference in the country. You look back at, I know as a catcher, I was fortunately taken in the sixth round. Mike Hubbard from James Madison was taken in the fifth round. Chris Widger from George Mason was taken in the third round. Mike Hubbard and Chris Widger are a year younger than I am. So, for 2 years you had, some decent draft picks and Chris Widger ended up catching in the big leagues for the Seattle Mariners for years. And, I really didn't have a chance to keep up with Mike Hubbard, but I think Wilmington had Corey Broom maybe a couple years later. So, from just my position alone, I thought it was as good as any catching core as there was in the country.
So coming off the excellent 89 season, talk about that 90 campaign, the Pirates finished 47-9 with the best winning percentage in the country. And you guys got off to just an unbelievable start, as you would guess, with that type of record. Just lost one game in your first probably 20 or 25 games without adding it up. But and that included going down to Auburn. That is where that lone defeat early on came. And then you played a pair against the Tigers, and you obviously won the other one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that was a great experience. That was really the first time we had, kind of gone to an SEC program in my career. And, we were excited. John Gass actually transferred from Auburn. So he had some familiarity, and, John and I were roommates on the road, and somebody was knocking at our door. It rained for like 2 days down there, so we weren't able to do a whole lot. And Coach Baird had set us up with a meal at the Omni Hotel, and we ate good and get back to the hotel room or the place we were staying and get a knock on the door, and somebody grabs John and throws him on the bed. And John looked like a midget, and John's about, I don't know what he weighs now, but he was about 6'4", 240. And this guy, I'm going, who in the world? And it was Frank Thomas. So he and Frank, I don't know if they were roommates when he was at Auburn, but really, really close friends. So, got to meet him down there. At that time, he was just starting to make a name for himself in baseball. And beating Auburn, the first game we played on, it was a battle. That field was ginormous. If you think about somebody hitting 25 home runs at Auburn in those days, I mean, that was a man. And I think we took BP one day, and we may have hit two or three balls out as a squad. Going down there and getting the feel of, hey, we're as good as anybody in the country. That was a good feeling. And then we kind of propelled off that throughout the rest of the year. That team was, that was a veteran team. And, you had Tim Langdon. I think Tim's record was like 12-1 or 12-2. And Jonathan Jenkins was like 13-1. So when we went down to Miami, it rained for five straight days. And we didn't get a chance to do any baseball. So I think we actually got a little cold. And the Citadel had won like their last 25 games coming into that region. So we knew they were hot also. So, we ended up beating, I think we beat South Florida. Then we had to end up playing the Citadel, and the Citadel ended up beating us. And then we had to turn around the next day and play a quick turnaround game, and we ended up losing NC State. But I think, here again, you try to go back and play it through your head. I think if we'd have gone down there, because honestly, Miami, if we hadn't played that game, or hadn't played that regional in like 3 days, they were going to send Miami to the College World Series because they were a number one seed. And so it was like every day was a doubleheader. And it just, you know, it was unfortunate to have a great season like that come to an end. But, you know, those guys, you know, I say, you know, that group of guys, we were closest friends, teammates, you know, and I say it's one of the greatest teams of all time.
Yeah, no doubt. And for the younger Pirate fan, back in those days, the NCAA tournament only had 48 teams rather than 64, and the regionals were six teams as opposed to four like they are now. So a much different format as far as how a coach or coaches were going about things strategically.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. It's, you know, being a part of two super regionals, you know, it's a different ballgame. You know, obviously tough getting through the first regional and then stacking up against, you know, basically you get back to your rotation. It's not about matchups then. It's about, you know, you're number one against the other team in the super regionals, number one, and going head to head. So, you know, that's, I think, you know, with us back in, even in 90, you know, if you get through a regional back then, you had to have at least five to six really good starters. And, you know, now I'm not saying that that's not the case now. I think you got to have tons of depth in the bullpen the way it's set up now. But, you know, you definitely want three great starters, maybe a fourth in going into a regular regional, and then, you know, really a lot of really talented relievers.
Moving on to that 91 season, you know, coming off the 47-9 campaign, you lost Tim Langdon. You also lost Jonathan Jenkins, correct?
Oh yeah.
So you're losing a lot of pitching, and not as good of a season early on. But then you guys started putting it all together, and you won the last five games of the regular season, and then obviously, you know, swept your way, I believe, through the tournament, and took a lot of momentum out to Wichita.
Yeah, and that, you know, that group, you know, we had some younger guys that come in, and, you know, that group was, you know, we felt they gelled very well with you know, I was just a junior that year, so, you know, we still had quite a few seniors on that squad, and you know, going out to Wichita here, again, we were the last team in, per se. We were the 48th team, and so we matched up against the number one team in the country. And, you know, Johnny Beck started that game, pitched very well. And, you know, we ended up losing the game. I can't remember the exact score. But, you know, Wichita, it's a different atmosphere there, too. You know, you got half turf infield, or it was turf infield, grass outfield. At that time, they had Chris Wimmer and Billy Hall on their squad. And the only reason I remember those two guys is because of the scouting report or just any type of information out there. I think Chris Wimmer had like 52 stolen bases and maybe Billy Hall had like 51 or 52. And I'm thinking, you know, we ain't stolen 100 bases in 2 years. Now we're going to face two guys that have stolen 105 this year. And the scouting report was on both of them was they could cut the light off and be in bed before it got dark.
Yeah, I was talking to Coach Gene Stevenson yesterday, and I was telling you this off the air, or some of these things, but I did not mention this. As far as the stolen bases, he started rattling off some of these numbers. I was looking through, and obviously East Carolina has a very, very proud baseball tradition and so much success. I was looking at the career steals record. I don't know. It was like 75, 80. It wasn't much more than that, if any. And and then you have 95, 67. He was naming like three and four guys, like you're saying, with 60-plus stolen bases, just crazy in one season.
Well, a lot of that has to do with that turf, too. Now, these guys were fast. I mean, they were super fast, but – you know, playing on the turf, and it wasn't this sports turf that, you know, we're playing on nowadays. It was true AstroTurf.
Right. The old carpet.
Yes, it was, It was a it's a different beast, and I was, you know, I played on some in Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia during some young timer games, and I'm glad I never had to play on an everyday basis, because you know, when it gets 100 degrees, that turf's probably 115, and just not fun baseball back in those days on that type of turf.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up the old vets. One of the Pirate football players that we had on from the early 90s or mid-90s, when the Pirates played there in 94, maybe one of the offensive linemen, they said that was far and away the worst field they ever played on, talking about how hard it was.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it was laid – the way they used to do that, from my understanding, they used to lay it on top of asphalt. So it's not laid on concrete or a crush and run. It's actually laid on top of asphalt. And I'm like, you know, it's got to be miserable, especially when it gets super hot. But yeah, I'm not so sure that, you know, as a football player, taking the beating they're already taking, and you know, obviously then hitting that type of surface would be too fun at all.
Yeah, no doubt. And so, like you already mentioned, you were a junior in that 91 season. Talk about what it was like, and as the season was winding down. You obviously got drafted in the sixth round by the Phillies. And did you know that you were pretty much going to be done after your junior year prior to the draft? Or did you have it, you had a pretty good idea of where you were going to go?
Not really. I mean, that's where the Major League draft and just the whole deal is totally different. I had gone out to dinner one time with a scout, you know, just talking about, you know, asking me if I could play third base. And I was like, so I started taking ground balls at third base. And now John Gass was our third baseman, so I knew that wasn't going to be in the cards as far as playing, but I would take ground balls at third. And so anyway, I said, I mean, I'm all for it. I mean, the opportunity to play professional baseball, and, you know, back then, the only news, any news at all, was coming through Baseball America, and you would only get it once a month. So prior to the draft, maybe a month before the draft, you know, they list the top players in the country, and they put them in positions, and they tell you what round they think that you may go in. And honestly, my sophomore year was probably one of my sophomore year was my best year, and then my junior year, I struggled a little bit, and I just didn't have the protection in the lineup like I did my sophomore year. And so anyway, I was pressing on myself, and I was getting a lot of walks, and, you know, I was swinging at bad pitches just because I wanted to hit. But they listed me, you know, to go anywhere from the second to the fourth round. So, you know, that's basically that's all you could go by. And the scout from the Mariners asked me, you know, they were thinking about taking me in the fourth round as a third baseman. Here again, I really didn't care. So come draft day, you know, you're sitting by, an old dial phone, and, you know, you have to sit by that phone to get the call. And so the scout from the Phillies called me, and he said, hey, this is Roy Tanner. And I knew Roy, and he actually drafted I don't think he drafted. He actually coached Billy Best in pro ball. So I had known Roy for years. And he goes, we just took you. I was like, so the Phillies. I said, boy, I hadn't even talked to you guys. So that was the end of the conversation. He said, I'm going to come to your house. I don't know. Give me 2 days. I'm going to drive in and come see you. So I don't know what round I went in. They don't tell you on the phone, because I guess they just at that time didn't want you to start getting your bargaining together. So when they came in and he told me what round, I was, you know, I was kind of disappointed, but at the same time, I really went back and I said, you know what, this team liked me better than any other team. And so, you know, did some negotiating, you know, back then the money, not even close to what it is now. I think Ben McDonald was a first rounder maybe the year before and had signed for like $195,000 as the number one overall pick. And the just going back to my freshman year, I played in the Cape after my freshman year, And my roommate was Scott Erickson. Scott Erickson was a third rounder for the Minnesota Twins, and he was in the Cape holding out for $30,000. And I was like, you know, go back to those days. You know, now I don't even know what six rounders are getting right now. You know, I know the first five rounds is big money, and then it drops off a little bit like that. But, you know, it's a different day and age. And, you know, I was just excited. You know, going into the season, you know, you're just hoping to get drafted. But at the same time, you know, I was fortunately able to get my college education paid for through Major League Baseball, which, you know, I came out of college debt-free thanks to that and also my parents.
Yeah, as far as the scholarship situation, since you brought it up, obviously now 11.7 is well-documented and often talked about as far as how folks feel it should be more as it was in the past. And obviously all that ties back in with Title IX. But just talk about back in those days, obviously you were playing, not coaching, but do you have any idea, was East Carolina, do we have the full allotment of scholarships?
Well, I'm not 100% sure what the, you know, the percentages were back then. You know, the way you look at 11.7, if you're fully funded, you can go out and get 11.7 or give that to out-of-state kids. I don't know. Even when I was coaching at East Carolina, we couldn't go out and recruit every player out of state because the percentage goes up when you obviously offer them more money.
Right.
So, you know, the 11.7, yeah, it's crazy. It, you know, and here again, unfortunately, you know, you see a lot of, I think North Carolina Central dropped their program or announced yesterday. You know, in a lot of situations, it's not a revenue sport. And the way we looked at it, you know, back in the coaching days over there was, you know, if we can pay for our, if we're able to pay for our sport, and not make money above and beyond that, then we've probably done pretty good. Just that way you're not running in the red. But with scholarships, I think, you know, athletes spend more time at the school than probably anybody else, unless you're a doctor, you know, fighting to put that name in the national spotlight, you know. I can say this, you know, they deserve everything they get. And we're very appreciative of, you know, the Pirate Club, you know, helping fund that. I think that's something else that's, you know, obviously gotten bigger and better, you know, through the years. And, you know, it takes, you know, former players like myself and my wife, who's alumnus, you know, we need to get more of our former players involved in the Pirate Club. Why there's a disconnect a little bit, I don't know. I mean, I talk to, you know, some of those guys a lot, talk to some of them a little, love to see more of them at, you know, football games, baseball games. But, you know, we're in I guess it's fortunate we're in a situation where, you know, we're raising families. You know, we got a lot of stuff going on besides athletics. And I think, you know, that's the reason the older generation, we see more of them at, you know, Pirate Club events and also Pirate home games. And, you know, I hope that in the near future that, you know, even more of my former teammates can get back to Greenville and we can get together a little bit more.
Yeah, like you're saying, depending on where folks are living and especially, you know, having kids that are playing youth sports, it's hard to get to Greenville as much as you would like to. But, you know, now with the games being on ESPN Plus and ECUPirates.com, hopefully those guys can at least tune in and follow the program as much as they can.
Oh, I'm sure they do. I mean, you know, it's, you know, the times that we were able to talk or, you know, just like seeing Calvin Brown on the show, I hadn't seen Calvin in person. I can't remember the last time I saw Calvin. And, you know, he was, you know, a dear friend, is a dear friend. And I know his family's growing and, you know, living in Richmond. So, you know, Richmond's not but three hours away, though. You know, we need to get him back down south. And John Gass is all over the world in his job. So just try to keep him in the Baltimore is a tough chore.
Yeah, enjoyed our chat, I guess it's over a year ago now, with John Gast and talking about his days in Major League Two.
Oh, yeah. Every time it comes on, he was in my wedding. So I can't let my daughters watch the whole thing, but every time we were able to pull it up and John, you know, is kind of strutting around in the clubhouse, we tell, you know, he was a part of our wedding.
But Tommy, talking about your professional career, what it was spanned over 5 years. Did you actually play four? Because you had an injury, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, they don't even count your first year as a year.
Okay.
So, 91, go to, you know, down to Clearwater, ended up breaking camp, going to Batavia, New York. And, you know, that was different. You know, Batavia, New York, not a whole lot there. Genesee Community College is actually the dorms we stayed in while playing there. Fortunately, pitcher and myself got called up, and it was actually going down to Spartanburg, South Carolina. So we got called up to our low A team. So I ended up the year in Spartanburg, went to spring training the following year, broke camp with Spartanburg, played the majority of that year, and that's when I ended up having arm problems. And at the end of, I guess that was 92, was down in Clearwater, Florida. Spring training, had rehab my arm. Something just wasn't right. I think I had upwards of like 20 x-rays. I know for a fact I had three MRIs. Had one in Philadelphia and two down in Clearwater, or actually in Tampa. And they told me, you know, it was nothing, just need to do some rehab. During that spring training, ended up swinging the bat, and my elbow just kind of locked up, and just told him, I said, something's not right. I said, do you mind if I choose another doctor? And I got all the x-rays and the MRIs sent to Dr. Bartlett here in Greenville. And at the time, Dr. Bartlett said he had never done Tommy John surgery. So I was scared to death of that. Back then, the way it worked also is, you know, Frank Jobe was in California, and Dr. Andrews, you know, obviously was one of the doctors, but you had to pay for the trip yourself. So I wasn't making big league money, and trying to go to see Jobe in California, going to see Dr. Andrews. And I don't think Andrews was in Birmingham at that time. So I came home, and Dr. Bartlett, you know, he basically said, if I go in, do exploratory surgery, and you come out of surgery and you've got a slit on your left wrist, then I did Tommy John. So when I woke up, I first looked at my left wrist and I said, he didn't do Tommy John. But I had a bone chip that was embedded in my ligament, and it was causing all the issues. And so my rehab was so different than it is now. The interval throwing program that, and it was a very similar surgery to Tommy John, but they just used the same ligament that was already there. Basically went back in, tied it, put a titanium anchor in the bone, tied it back where it was supposed to be, because what happened, that bone chip had scrubbed on the ligament, and every time it was scrubbing, it was adding calcium, which was also adding length to the ligament. So I rehabbed for 3 months and was back 100% after 3 months, and ended up going to Clearwater for half the season, I think 93. No, that this is 94. And then I ended up halfway through the season going up to Reading, Pennsylvania, and playing Double A. Ended up the season pretty well there. went back to Double A in 1995, was a Double A All-Star, and ended up, you know, we won the Eastern League Championship in 95 with a group of guys. Scott Rowland was on that team during the year. He ended up making it to the big leagues at the end of that year, so he wasn't with us. So, you know, playing with a great group of guys in 95. And then at the end of 95, get a phone call. I think it's October. I'd gone to the Arizona Fall League in 94 at the year of the strike and was put on the 40-man roster at the end of the 94 season. And so going into 95, they took me off the roster to make room for all the free agents that were in Melbourne working out after the strike. And so I ended up, you know, having a really, really good 95 season. And I got traded in the offseason. And the trade was kind of weird. Jeff Juden, who ended up having a great year that year for maybe the Cleveland Indians, or because that was the year the transition from Montreal didn't have a team and all that stuff. And so I got traded to the San Francisco Giants and didn't know a thing about the Giants, had never heard anything, rumors or anything. And so anyway, went to spring training with the Giants. And at the end of spring training, they wanted to send me back to Double A, which was in Shreveport, Louisiana. And not that this was the case, but that's where we played our Double A All-Star game. And it was 105 degrees and 100% humidity. And I was like, being a catcher in Shreveport, Louisiana is going to be absolutely miserable. But at that time, I made a life decision. At the end of spring training, when they told me I was going to go back to Double A and I was going to platoon with Doug Mirabelli, who ended up was a catcher at Wichita State.
Right.
I just, you know, I thought that I had proved myself at that level. I need to be in Triple A to learn from the big leaguers that were down in Triple A. And so I made a decision, you know, it was time for me from a health standpoint. I was diagnosed, I think in 94, at the end of 94 season in Arizona Fall League with diabetes. So that was probably one of the biggest decisions dealing with this disease back then compared to now, so different. The medicines are different, which is, you know, it's in a good way. But I think if I had the medicines I have now back then, I probably would have tried to continue to play.
Yeah, that's a shame. I was not aware of that part of the story. I knew you had battled the arm injury. I hate that was the case. But you talk about your numbers in that final season. Your average wasn't quite as good, but you had hit 14 home runs and driven in 50. So just talk about what are your memories of that season?
Well, I mean, that like I said, diabetes is a roller coaster, especially with your eyes. So I'd gone to an eye doctor, and I thought I was having problems just focusing, and I had more strikeouts that year. And so went to the eye doctor, and she tried to give me contacts. And my eyes have always been sensitive, so trying to put contacts in, I was, like, half the locker room was trying to help me. And finally, I told her I couldn't wear them. I went back to see her, and I asked her, I said, ma'am, I said, you know, you're trying to put me in contacts, but what is my vision? And she said, well, you're 20-point, I think it was 20/10 in one eye and 20/15 in the other eye. And I go, that's better than 20/20, right? And she said, yeah, but you're a little bit nearsighted in one eye. I was like, okay, so that's not my problem. And so finally, I got my medicines right, the timing of them. And at the end of the year is when I started picking up. I ended up the regular season with 14 home runs. But when we started the Eastern League playoffs, I ended up hitting like 480 with 5 home runs and 17 RBIs. So that was where I ended up season with 19 home runs. And I, like I said, I ended up like 67 RBIs because of the championship play. And so, you know, going into that, you know, I'm thinking, okay, you know, maybe next year, you know, I get an opportunity to start off good, you know, make it to the big leagues as a, you know, September call up. But, you know, here again, you know, things happen for a reason. You know, I was able to come back to East Carolina, finish my degree, and the next year get on the coaching staff with Keith.
Let's talk about that, Coach. Very excited to have you on, by the way, for 23 Jungle Tales. Keith LeClair, obviously very special to the program. How did you hook up with Keith? Did he just call you up and say, hey, I want you on the staff? How did you become a part of the staff?
That's crazy. So Keith and I had never met. When we played Western Carolina, when he was on the coaching staff with Jack Leggett, he was actually recruiting the weekend. And I hit three home runs in one game against Western. And so Coach Leggett, you know, knew who I was and, you know, as a player. And then Keith came in, you know, we only had one full-time assistant. And he was bringing, you know, Coach Mazie in. And he called me up. Actually, he didn't call me. It was Dr. Van Zandt. He said, look, I need to meet with you. And at that time, I was, you know, finishing my undergraduate. And so I went up to see Dr. Van Zandt. And I'm not so sure Dr. Van Zandt wasn't acting athletic director at the time. And because we were in transition.
That's correct.
Right.
We sat there in his office and talked. And at that time, I had been offered several jobs in the insurance sales. And I didn't know if I wanted to get into college coaching. I needed to start making some money somewhere. So I ended up meeting with Dr. Van Zandt. He said, can I set up a meeting with Keith? And I said, yeah, I'll talk with him. And so met Keith in his office, you know, just a go-getter, you know, asked me, you know, what my thoughts were. And I said, you know, I don't know that I can afford it. And so the package back then was, you know, I hope young people hear this because I made $300 a month as a grad assistant. And I was teaching bowling, archery, and I can't remember what else I taught. But then I was also making a little money as a head groundskeeper. So I took care of the field. I was doing Joey Perry's job back then when I first started at East Carolina. So if there was an issue on the field, it was my job. So you know what? I grew up in that kind of environment. And so I, you know, said, yeah, I'll give it a shot. And so I ended up finishing my undergraduate and then started grad school. My first year on staff, and ended up getting my master's. And at the end of that, I was the first second paid assistant in basically the history of East Carolina baseball. So, you know, I helped break down those walls of getting the second assistant as a full time employee.
Hey, Tommy, did you tell Joey that Harrington Field, or now Clark LeClair, has never looked as sharp as that field at Harrington did back in 98?
I can't tell him that. You know, Joey and I talk all the time, especially right now with this rain and, you know, putting the tarp on and off. Now, he, you know, he does a great job. And honestly, it's, you know, I'm back to, you know, with, you know, two assistant coaches of basically taking care of this field. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, I enjoy my craft and my trade, and, you know, I chose this profession, and I've enjoyed it. I mean, you know, I've enjoyed Pitt Community College. It's been a great situation for me and my family. And, you know, right now that's, you know, that's the part of my life that, you know, I'm glad I'm at where I'm at.
And Coach, talk about that. With you had obviously the time at East Carolina and the staffs there, and then you move on to Pitt Community College. Talk about that time at East Carolina, but that sets you up nicely because you've done such an excellent job at Pitt Community for the Bulldogs.
Well, I appreciate that, Dave. I you know, a lot of the things that, well, you know, maybe not today and you know, the COVID, you know, type situations, it's tougher to do things like you really like to, you know, in the weight room. And basically we've been running our stuff in pods most of the fall and, you know, still doing a lot of pod work in the spring. But, you know, when the transition from East Carolina and I was able to get the job at Pitt, I think the biggest thing was trying to make sure we were doing the things to prepare our guys to get back to an East Carolina or the schools that our guys have gone on to play at. You know, the situation, you know, with Coach Goblin and I, you know, he's not going to come recruit every player in East Carolina. He can only recruit what his needs are. And, you know, the fortunate situation is, you know, I've fortunately had some players go play for Coach Goblin. You know, and the good thing about it, you know, Parker Lamb was a captain. You also got to look at Andrew Hendrickson, both, you know, both playing the outfield over there, and did a great job for Coach Goblin. I think, you know, Pitt Community College and the mentality we try to portray and present, you know, tries to prepare those guys. We don't have the, you know, the staff that, you know, East Carolina does. So a lot of stuff is limited, but at the same time, mentally and physically and those types of situations, we try to prepare them the best we can.
Yeah, you brought up Parker Lamb. Parker Lamb, really, you know, one of the heart and soul pieces of that 2016 Super Regional team that nearly made it to Omaha. I remember the performance he had and some of the plays he made up in Charlottesville when the Pirates won that regional. And then Andrew Hendrickson, I remember a tremendous catch he had at Clark LeClaire against South Carolina.
Oh, yeah. Those guys, I mean, you know, both of those guys, former players, are first and foremost good people. And you know, they both wanted East Carolina. You know, that was the biggest thing. That was kind of their heart and soul. And, you know, Parker being here with me for 2 years, you know, that was the first year I think Cliff was at East Carolina. So, you know, he was looking kind of to fill some needs. He really didn't know what he had coming in. And I kind of presented both of them, you know, as, you know, status quo, work hard, can do a lot of good things. Don't know what they'll be able to do at your level. That's, and at the time of his transition, he didn't have a chance to go watch those guys play. Or maybe not Parker, but Andrew did. And then Andrew, you know, basically, you know, his dad played at East Carolina back in the, you know, earlier 80s. I'm not going to say exactly what year because Sam will kill me if I mix, you know, mess it up. But, you know, Andrew was a hard worker. He had a great career for me. I felt like he could contribute. Where he contributed, that was up to Coach Goblin. And same thing with Parker. Parker played second base for me, but he always wanted to play the outfield, but I needed for him to play second base. So, you know, he did what he was, you know, asked to do for me. And then he flourished more as an outfielder at East Carolina. And, you know, sometimes that's just the way it works.
Coach, talk about that very thing with Pitt Community. I know you guys have had a great program with the way things are going. You were talking earlier back in the interview about recruiting and how difficult it is. How are things different as far as there are different rules or different ways that that you can tell our audience about? I know it's got to be really difficult because now you've got to, you were talking about with trusting the people that have been helping you out, like almost kind of like AKA scouts, I guess, different people you trust, but it's really hard. Now you can make a lot of, not that you do, but it's easy to miss on a player, I guess, for a guy that you think is good and may not be good, or vice versa, a guy that you miss on that turns out to be great at another program, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we're probably as patient as anybody, just because we want the right 30 guys in the program. You know, there's a lot of players out there that want to play college baseball. I want them to have the opportunity to play college baseball, but we can't take every player that wants to come to the Pit. We have to pick and choose our battles. We do a lot of character background, you know, searches, and We talk to people that are around them, people that know them. So we want good character players, and we want good students. I know Coach Godwin and we do too. I think this past semester, I don't think it's been publicized, and we should, but our team GPA was a 3.41. And, you know, going through the pandemic online, we were very fortunate to have good students. And fortunately, they're good student athletes. So there's a lot that goes into it. I've never been one to rush. Hopefully, we can get out and watch some high school baseball. I like to watch players play on their high school teams simply because those are the guys they grew up with. They're the ones they're going to play the hardest for. And a lot of times, you know, if it's a bad character, they're going to act, you know, they're not going to hold themselves as accountable because they've been around them so long. So it's kind of a catch 22. You want to see them play with their best friends they've grown up with. But sometimes when they play with their best friends, they show signs of maybe not doing things the right way, maybe not hustling like they should. Because, you know, the reality is we always say, you know, the effort shows up every day. You know, you may have a bad day as far as, you know, your hitting, fielding, but the effort level needs to be 100% every day.
Now, Coach, I know we talked about Coach LeClaire and how you joined his staff back in 1998. And when we've had you on in the past, we talked about everything that Coach LeClaire meant to you and all that you learned from him. But, you know, if you had to narrow it down to two or three things, you know, what were some of the biggest takeaways that you had from Coach LeClaire, whether it was during your time coaching with him or, you know, after he had to step away, just the way he handled his situation with such grace and you know, used it as a positive?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of rules. We basically had one rule, and it was do the right thing. So if you're questioning that, you probably need to take a step back and look at yourself in the mirror. He was an extremely hard worker, and practices were 100%. Sometimes, we had some injuries show up because we went so hard at times, but that was just the way that, you know, he coached, and he wanted his staff to coach. And, you know, I had no problem with that. I think he continued to battle, you know, once after that regional in Kinston with some of the issues that started showing up. You know, nobody, I mean, at that time knew that he had family members that had ALS. And we were all, you know, hoping it was definitely something else. But, you know, the gradual decline in his health, never affected his mind. You know, even with the eye gaze and the first, he had a computer that he could type in and then it would talk. He still wanted to coach, and he couldn't be at practice every day. And, you know, there'll be some days he'd show up for practice and sit on the bench. And obviously the guys were concerned about him. And, you know, at that time, you know, you didn't hear much about it. And now I think with social media and with everything, the platforms that are going on by ALS, it's such a better known disease nowadays. I had to, back then I had to do my research and find out exactly what ALS was. I mean, back then you're thinking of Lou Gehrig, and, you know, I wasn't around when Lou Gehrig was playing, so I didn't really know what to expect. And I was unfortunately got to witness the decline in his health, but, you know, the adversity and the fight and the will from a mindset was unbelievable. And his faith grew tremendously through that time. And, you know, a lot of caregivers, Chuck Young, a lot of players, would have rather it not ever happen, but right now I can say they wouldn't have traded that time with him for anything in the world.
yeah, some of those devotionals that he penned, so to speak, and with his eye gaze computer, just reading those and just thinking that, hey, Coach LeClaire wrote this with everything that he was going through and with that eye gaze computer, and that he wasn't feeling sorry for himself. You know, anytime that we might be having a bad day, like, how could I dare feel sorry for myself with everything he went through, and he was still, you know, doing everything he could to help other people.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, that was just him in general. You know, Keith went to Western Carolina as a walk-on and ended up being, you know, one of the best players that ever played at Western Carolina. So, you know, his determination and it began at a lot younger age than, you know, obviously the time that I spent with him. And, you know, even through his battle, especially early on, you know, he continued to try to do things that, you know, which, like I said, at the time, I didn't know what to expect, what he was capable of doing, not capable of doing, because of just not enough attention brought to the disease like it is now. And, you know, obviously we're hoping for a cure. You know, this is a terrible disease. You know, it's not even something that, you know, it seems like there's a lot of hope or a lot of light at the end of the tunnel right now. But, you know, I know that there's a ton of research, and the, you know, Eastern, the ALS Catfish Hunter Association here in Eastern North Carolina has done a great job. You know, we used to help out with the walk, and they moved it to the spring. I, you know, really don't know where it stands right now with obviously the COVID and stuff, but hopefully people continue to contribute. I know Cliff does a lot for the ALS Association, and you know, hopefully all that money is used and finally brings a cure to this thing.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know, out of all of the awesome East Carolina athletics experiences and, you know, just memories from games, whether it's, you know, football, basketball, baseball, the top moment, in my opinion, for me personally, was in 2002 at the Conference USA tournament there at Granger Stadium, because it was about more than the sport, with Coach LeClaire down the right field line.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that was great. You know, I think the Clemson regional at the same time was as memorable, even though we didn't win a championship down there or win the regional. You know, those guys, after a loss, the final loss we took, went down, and Clemson had put him in the right field, down the right field line there also. And after the loss, going down there and dumping the Gatorade bath on the van. And, you know, that's as strong a memory as a championship that, you know, those guys showed great character through win and defeat. And, you know, that's the reason those guys were a special group.
Yeah, and getting sent to Clemson with Coach Leggett, obviously.
No, absolutely. And, you know, Keith's widow, Lynn, being from Pickens, obviously right around the corner from Clemson. And, you know, just a lot of things worked out in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I think she's moved back to Pickens. And so, you know, that's where she's from, family's from. And like I said, just like I said, the character of him and the group of guys that he coached. And for me, it was, you know, he is and has always just been a blessing.
Coach, I know that 2001, that super regional with Tennessee, there's a lot of things I think about with Coach LeClaire and you guys. If we could have hosted it in Greenville, obviously at that time with Harrington, not big enough to host a regional, but it was just an amazing experience. And when he said, paraphrasing, if this is the worst thing that will ever happen to you, then you'll probably have a good life. I mean, I still get chill bumps. I almost have tears in my eyes thinking about right before, I guess that was before, I think that was before his diagnosis. But just to tell guys that when you're so close to Omaha, knowing how much Omaha means to a college baseball player, and I guess you guys, I mean, I can't imagine how many hours you guys put in as coaches. So you guys have so much invested, and you're that close to Omaha. And Kinston, a great historic stadium. I mean, we could go on and on, but when he says stuff like that, I mean, you just can't help but root for the guy.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, fortunately, you know, in 2010 here, we ended up making it to Junior College World Series in Grand Junction. And 2017, we went to Enid, Oklahoma for Division II Junior College World Championships. And I think I said the same thing after the final loss in those World Series is, you know, it's, you know, first and foremost, it's a privilege to play college baseball. And as long as you can look at yourself in the mirror and you put it all on the table, you know, like I said, that's, if that's the worst that ever happens to you, it's a really good life, without a doubt.
Coach, I know we've kept you. One, I wanted to ask you before we let you go, can you talk a little bit about your ball club this year? And I know you guys, do you guys have the game against Mount Olive? I know that wonderful thing in North Carolina we call weather has been kind of crazy here the last handful of days and early in the season, but I know the Mount Olive is on your schedule.
Yeah, we're actually moving that game to Mount Olive. Okay. They're a little bit how they're any drier than we are because we're still pretty wet, but so we made that decision. We're going to go over there, play a single nine-inning game at 3 o'clock tomorrow. Our guys are chomping at the bit. You know, it's been since March of last year since we played a true game, and I think everybody around the country is kind of in the same boat. No pun intended as far as the boat's concerned. But, you know, I like our squad. I mean, we're older. We've got, you know, I think our pitching staff's got a chance to be really good. I think offensively we're as good as we were last year before COVID hit. But, you know, here again, it's about, you know, taking the adrenaline that you're on a field against somebody else. It's going to be different than it is as an inner squad. So I'm excited to see that part of it. And hopefully we get, you know, 4 games on this weekend so everybody can get there. You know, we've got to extend some pitching, get them more innings. Tomorrow's probably going to be more of a Johnny Holstaff type, trying to get everybody some work to get ready for the weekend. But, you know, Mount Olive's JV, they'll be a solid program. They have really good players in their program. And it also gives Mount Olive a chance to look at the players on our team that are looking to go somewhere else next year. So it's a double-edged sword. You want to go over there and obviously play well, beat them. But for them, it's an opportunity for them to see our players compete on their own field.
No doubt about it. And I know that, Bubba, I know we had a couple people chime in real quick. If we could get those up on the screen for Coach real quick. William Grant says, Bubba Grant, says, if I ever faced with a difficult decision, I asked myself, what would Keith LeClair do? And he said, thanks for sharing, Coach. Very special. And then Rob Bark says, dude, sure was a monster. So appreciate certainly you coming on, Coach. I hope that you'll come back. We do a thing called Extra Innings. I know you may be aware of, and love to have you back on to talk about East Carolina baseball, obviously, but also talk about your club because you've done so much for East Carolina as a player, coach, now at Pitt Community. We could talk to you for several hours and probably still not have your whole career and everything covered. So we appreciate the time, and we went longer than we normally do, but we wanted to make sure we did the 23 Jungle Tales with you that we did it justice.
Well, I appreciate you guys, and we appreciate you guys bringing back some memories of some old colleagues and teammates, and hopefully it's something y'all continue to do in the future.
Thanks, Coach.
There's no question about it. Thank you so much. Good luck against Mount Olive tomorrow.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And hopefully I'll see you in Section 15 this fall, Coach.
Yeah, no kidding. It's time for some football, too.
Absolutely. Exactly. Go Pirates. Take care.
Take care, Coach. All right, bye-bye. Coach Tommy Eason of Pitt Community College. Appreciate him so much. Bubba, I know that we didn't mean to keep him that long, but it's really hard. I guess a guy like Tommy Eason, you probably have to have a focus on player, focus on Keith LeClair, Maisie. Obviously, you know, I mentioned didn't say pro career, but certainly there's so much to talk about. But we'll have him back on certainly throughout the season. Speaking of which, extra innings we've got coming up on. We'll talk about programming, but extra innings is coming on Sunday, right?
Yeah, and the season debut of extra innings. Obviously, we've had extra innings the last couple of years, and last year was much more consistent than the first year. Corey Glore or Coach O, Gary Overton joined us on a weekly basis to recap on whatever games the Pirates played that week. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we'll have plenty of baseball to talk about this year. Our guys, I know obviously these guys are used to excelling in every area of life. And we talked about academically, you know, 3.6 GPA as a team, just remarkable. And then everything they do in the community and obviously on the field. So I know our guys, as much as they want to play, that they'll do the right thing and they'll be disciplined and keep themselves out of harm's way and allow us to play ball games. So hopefully our opponents will do the same. But Rhode Island coming in, I'll be catching up with their head coach, Rafael Serrato, on Wednesday morning sometime. And we'll have that for you on Thursday evening, as well as the comments of Cliff Godwin, Matt Bridges, you know, senior reliever who got a year back with the COVID. And then also we'll catch up with catcher Seth Cadell.
No doubt it's going to be a great show on Thursday. We have a great show coming up tonight. If you're joining us live, we'll have Coach Mac McCarthy, right, for a regular show with a sports objective.
Yeah, we'll have Coach Mac, Bob Rathbun, the Atlanta Hawks play-by-play voice on TV. You know, he had to reschedule, had an obligation with the Hawks, but Bob will probably be able to join us next Thursday, so you'll get an opportunity to hear from him. But tonight we'll be talking college basketball for the most part, and I'm sure some other things. I know you follow NASCAR, and Coach Mack is a huge NASCAR fan, so that may come up as well in addition to college hoops.
Life, whatever he wants to talk about. We love Coach Mack very much. Thanks to Coach Tommy Easton. Appreciate you, Coach, very much. In fact, I want to remind fans once again that 23 Jungle Tales is brought to you by PGX Gloves, pgxgloves.com. Mark Minakazi, want to thank him for all the support. He's Pirates, supporting Pirates. I mean, the guys, Pirates through and through, and Bubba, they've got everything. They've got custom baseball gloves, batting gloves. How about some personalized stuff? And I know with you and I having youth, young kids, a lot of youth stuff, right?
Yeah, some of their digital camo batting gloves. Riley got some of those personalized with his name. And then you had also the custom gloves. Go to pgxgloves.com and check it out. So whatever colors, designs, your name, number, a message. For instance, one of the coaches out in Division II, Dakota State, in South Dakota, he was a family friend of Keith LeClaire. So Kaz sent me a custom glove he did for him, and it had KL23 on it, very sharp looking. And then the Lion logo on the pocket of the glove. So very sharp looking, and definitely go to pgxgloves.com and check it out. A lot of sharp looking swag as well. Hats, shirts, hoodies, you name it.
No doubt. Again, appreciate it very much. pgxgloves.com. And by the way, I want to mention, too, one more thing before we go. Our extra innings is brought to you by Next Level Training Center in Greenville on Wimbledon Drive. We appreciate Trent Britt and company, his great wife, and everybody there for all they do. And I can't wait to get back there and take Alexander McKenzie. They had a blast. It was March 20th, Alexander's birthday last year when we went. I look forward to doing that again. And Bubba, man, thank you so much for your hard work behind the scenes and doing 23 Jungle Tales. We've got a lot of great shows. We'll get out of here to get ready for our next show. But Bubba, as always, I want to thank you for all that you do, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm trying to concentrate here with Reese's Luke Combs concert going on in the background on the TV. But yeah, appreciate everyone tuning in whenever and however you're listening, whether it's right now live or archived on, you know, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And then our audio-only platforms, don't forget about those. If you're in the car and you don't want to bring up YouTube, maybe you don't have unlimited data, whatever the case may be, you can check us out on TuneIn Radio, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, SoundCloud, and pretty much anywhere you can find podcasts.
Yeah, if you count social media, it's over 20 outlets. So appreciate everybody, however you're viewing and listening, like Bubba said. All right, we'll wrap things up. The 23 Jungle Tales, again, brought to you by pgxgloves.com. Thanks to them very much there at the website. We'll get out of here, and thanks to Coach Tommy Eason, Hall of Famer for East Carolina. Until next time, you've been watching and listening to 23 Jungle Tales right here on the Sports Objective. And good night, and go Pirates.
You've been listening to 23 Jungle Tales, all on the Sports Objective, the unofficial podcast of the Pirates. All these interviews and our other content can be seen on our Facebook page and YouTube channel. Be sure to like, follow, and subscribe. The audio can be heard anywhere you listen to our show, including but not limited to Google Podcasts, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, and Apple Podcasts. Follow us on social media on Twitter at TheSportsOBJ, on Instagram at TheSportsObjective. Like and follow us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, we appreciate you listening to the show. Go Pirates!